Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. There was a shooting in Virginia Beach, Virginia, a few hours ago. Suspect in custody after active shooter situation near Virginia Beach City Hall. 4 injured. Police said multiple injuries have been confirmed. 3 patients were taken into Sentara Princess Anne Hospital. 1 patient was taken to Sentara Virginia Beach General Hospital, and a Nightingale Regional Air Ambulance landed at the scene to assist with operations. At this time, police believe there was only one shooter. That person has been taken into custody. That's all I have on this issue at this time. It's Friday, so that means it's panel time. We are joined by a man who is a journalist and political analyst. He's a frequent collaborator with all major news outlets, Caleb Maupin. Caleb, as always, welcome back.
And as always, glad to be here.
We're also joined by a man with a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California. His latest op-ed is entitled "Mueller Talks and the Tyrant Walks," Dr. Jack Rasmus. Jack, welcome back.
As always.
Last but not least, he's a political analyst, commentator, and editor of The Polemicist, and his latest op-ed is entitled "Swedish Sex Pistol Aimed at Assange." Jim Kavanaugh. Jim, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
Let's start quickly with the battle for the narrative. Special Counsel Robert Mueller III finally spoke publicly Wednesday, and his carefully chosen comments highlight the ways in which he disagrees with his boss, Attorney General William Barr, and the facts and the law surrounding the investigation into President Trump. One of the lines from his 9-minute presentation is, if we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. Mueller's remarks also made clear how heavily his office relied on a longstanding legal opinion from the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel that a sitting president cannot be indicted. That opinion, Mueller said, says the Constitution requires a process other than the criminal justice system to formally accuse a sitting president of wrongdoing. I don't agree with that. So, where was all of this weeks ago when Barr first came out with his spin machine? And what are we to make of Mueller, who infamously told us that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction?
As Director Tenet has pointed out, Secretary Powell presented evidence last week that Baghdad has failed to disarm its weapons of mass destruction, willfully attempting to evade and deceive the international community. Our particular concern is that Saddam Hussein may supply terrorists with biological, chemical, or radiological material.
Dr. Jack Rasmus, so where was all of Mueller's pushback weeks ago, and is it fair for me to open discussions about him by going back to his weapons of mass destruction conversation, Dr. Jack Rasmus?
Well, you know, it probably was all there in his report anyway, if you bothered to read it. You know, it's a litany of smoking gun charges here about obstruction of justice on the part of Trump. I mean, you know, you can hardly deny that there was obstruction of justice there. That's probably why Trump won't let McGahn, his lawyer, actually testify before Congress, because it will just reaffirm that the obstruction of justice was widespread. Now, it's interesting that, you know, why would, you know, Mueller not say that? You know, why would he not say there was obstruction of justice, even though he laid it out that there clearly was? Well, you get back to this rule, this bureaucratic rule that's been issued by the legal office of the Justice Department that says you can't indict a president, a sitting president, for criminal activity. Now, you know, what gives them the right to say that the Constitution says that? Because go read the Constitution. It doesn't say that.
Says nothing of the sort.
read Article 1, read Article 2. There's nothing in it that says a bureaucracy, some bureaucrat, can interpret the Constitution to mean that a president can commit crimes and not be indicted. He's above the law, in other words. Well, that's tyranny. You know, when you're above the law, that's tyranny, whether you're sitting president or not. And I don't think the Constitution ever implied that a president who committed obvious crimes could not be indicted. I mean, you know, you could start World War III, or you could mass incarcerate protesters, you know, and that's not a crime that can be indicted. But Mueller was very careful. He says, no, I'm going by the rule developed by the Justice Department, which is the body managed by the president. In other words, you're creating your own rule to protect yourself, the president is, from any kind of indictment. And, you know, he could have suggested, if it was so obvious that there is obstruction of justice, Mueller could have suggested that maybe the Congress might find that, or he could suggest that impeachment might have been possible or justified. But he's very, very careful not to imply in any way he's abiding by the rules of the Justice Department in violation of the Constitution, which raises the question, well, why?
Caleb Maupin, Robert Mueller, you know, the Republicans want to make him out to be this Democratic hitman. Where was he 3 weeks ago when Barr came out with his spin machine?
Well, you'll notice he did not criticize William Barr at any point. And I think it's also important to add that he said he was retiring. So you can imagine that the amount of stress that Mr. Mueller has been under during this two-year-long process has not been small. But look, I mean, at this point, the office of the special counsel is closed. The probe is over. The report is out. It says there was no collusion. It says they're not sure about obstruction and they didn't come to a clear conclusion. I guess why can't folks accept this? I mean, how much longer is there going to be ambiguity about this, right? They feel that they cannot bring charges against the president. Now, the Congress has options that they have, obviously. But at this point, I mean, the special counsel probe is over. And we have the same conclusion that was in the report. We now have a, you know, 9-minute statement from Bob Mueller repeating what was in the report. And everyone wants to interpret this as if this is some big bombshell announcement. You know, he clearly said that we should impeach. No, he didn't say that. That's not his job. He said what he said, and he reiterated what was in the report. And that's that. And I feel like this is the end of the special counsel probe. It's over. What Congress might want to do with it, or what Congress might want to continue things with, that's, you know, it's all in the future. It's ahead of us, and that's up to the Congress. But the Bob Mueller probe is history at this point. It's over. It's finished. It's done.
Jim Kavanaugh, 2 points. One, Mueller said, I believe, I'll paraphrase, I couldn't really speak further about obstruction because I didn't want to bring up an issue that couldn't be addressed in court. The other point is, and I've mentioned this a couple of times, should this have been an independent counsel instead of a special counsel?
I'm not sure about the latter distinction.
Mueller works for Barr. Independent counsel is independent and does not report to the Attorney General.
Yeah, exactly. And this is my point. I think there's a little bit of disagreement. Let me just state my position is here. Mueller works, as you say, works for the Attorney General. He works under the rubric that the Department of Justice declared, which is, you know, we may agree with it, want to change it, you know, that the president should not be indicted. He doesn't get to sit back and say, I'm not going to obey that, because that's the rule of the department that I'm working in. And so he had to do that. And there's been, throughout the Mueller investigation, there's been this kind of hope, and it has been a confusion between what Mueller was doing and what kind of the Democrats and the anti-Trumpers and the never-Trumpers hoped he would do. Mueller, by his own reckoning, could never bring an indictment against Trump, okay? He could lay out all kinds of evidence, okay? He did bring indictments against other people for certain things, but no indictments against any U.S. person for conspiracy. You know, now everybody say, oh, it wasn't collusion, it was conspiracy. Well, that, of course, legally, that's what it was all the time, because there's no legal thing of collusion. But it was the Dems and the media which were saying, oh, it's collusion, collusion, collusion. So Mueller was never going to do that, okay? He could lay out some evidence. And the reason And he did suggest impeachment. What Mueller has done is very, I think he's a snake. I think it goes back to the fact that he is part of the national security apparatus. He's part of the intelligence apparatus. He's connected to that. It's what he did with WMDs. And he did come out. He knew what the takeaway quote was going to be on this of his speech. And it was that if we had confidence that he committed a crime, didn't commit a crime, we would have said so. And that is, and he's done what Comey did to Hillary Clinton, which is to say, oh, I can't, I'm not indicting her, but look at all this evidence we have. And, you know, if someone else wants to do something, in Mueller's case, he's saying, you know, if someone else wants to do something, and if you want to impeach him, go ahead. Now, Mueller's job was to say, either I indict him, that's all he was, his job is, I indict him, or I decline to indict him. Here's the evidence. They put the evidence on paper, not to get up and make a speech about how someone else can do it if they want. Or that's what Mueller, that's what Comey did to Clinton. And Mueller knows what he's doing. He's trying to take himself out of it. He's not giving the Democrats what they wanted, which they were never going to get from him. A legal reason to indict Trump, to impeach Trump. That's what the Democrats are looking for. But he is giving them something, which he's saying, yeah, this is something you might be able to, information you might be able to use to impeach Trump. And, you know, it's up to the Democrats now. If they want to impeach him, impeach him. But it's going to be a political thing. I'm sorry. The reason Donald Trump was not indicted for obstruction was not only because of the rule. It was also because to get a conviction for obstruction of justice, you have to prove
intent.
It would have been very difficult to say his intention was to obstruct the thing rather than his intention was, I think this is a politically motivated campaign, and I don't want to be part of it. So that's what was going to be very difficult. And the Democrats know that would have been. So there's no legal charge here, okay? They're not going to get a legal charge. They're either going to say, we're going after Donald Trump for political reasons, but they can't depend on the Mueller report for those political reasons. It's going to be very bad to try and pretend that this is anything but a political campaign against Trump, and those who want to do it will do it, but they won't win. They won't get the impeachment.
And that takes me to my final question on this issue. I'll hit all three of you with this, starting with Jack. Do the Democrats have the information? But in my opinion, more importantly, do the Democrats really have the guts to push this impeachment move forward, or do they shoot themselves in the foot in the process? Jack Rasmus.
Well, if they impeached and started impeachment proceedings, they would have a kind of power of subpoena that they don't have now. And they would be able to force McGahn and others to come. And that would open up another can of worms. I think they would probably find even more evidence of obstruction of justice. It's very clear that Volume 2, the executive summary, lays out what our obstruction of justice actions, very similar to what was found against Nixon back in the 70s, obstruction of justice. That was the main problem they had with him. And I would like to comment, too, on the question of collusion. You know, what the report and what he said, Mueller said, is that they simply could not find sufficient evidence. But it's interesting. Why did Mueller not depose and interview Donald Trump Jr., who had direct contacts mm-hmm. and was part of the administration? Why didn't they not bring in Trump? You know, some talk of bringing in Trump and interviewing him. Well, you know, they deposed and brought Bill Clinton in. I mean, what's the difference here? You know, it looks like to me that Mueller purposely went very slow and carefully. And I think part of the problem, you know, may simply be he didn't want to go there and gave Trump all the benefit of the doubt, the Trump administration. And that was probably directed by the fact that he was only a special counsel and he had to abide by the rules. Why they agreed to that special counsel, you know, not an independent counsel, is an important question. But if the Democrats really want to impeach him, then they should start impeachment proceedings, and then they will be able to find out deeper what really went on. But I don't think they got the backbone to do that. I don't think this is a case closed. This is a case that's partially open, and whether they want to kick the door all the way open all depends upon their political backbone. But I don't think Pelosi has that backbone. And all this talk about, they will cause support for Trump, maybe lose the election. Look what happened under Clinton. Well, what happened under Clinton was the Republicans came back and won more seats in the House in 2000 and won the presidency in 2000 under shaky circumstances, but they won nonetheless. So this argument, it may cost us votes, I think is just a cover argument. I think the Democrats don't have the guts, to at least the leadership, to do that.
Caleb Maupin, if they did start impeachment proceedings, to Jack's point, they have additional subpoena power. And for a president to fail to respond to a subpoena in that context is an impeachable offense in and of itself. That was one of the three articles of impeachment that came out of the committee against Richard Nixon. It didn't go to the full House. He resigned before it got to the full House to vote. But that was one of the three articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon.
Sure. It's interesting. If you look at who's called for impeachment of Trump, a lot of the Democrats that are running for president said it. And I think that impeachment is a crowd pleaser. If you're running for the Democratic nomination and you say you want to impeach Donald Trump, you'll get a lot of applause for it.
It's Trump's build the wall.
Sure. And it sounds great. The actual nitty gritty of the case, especially if the issue is obstruction, is something that a lot of people are going to get lost in the details for. I'll tell you that. If Trump had shot somebody or something like that, that might be more exciting for the TV cameras. But obstruction of justice is a little bit of there's going to be a lot of people snoozing when those proceedings are on CNN if that ends up happening. But at the same time, I think it's a crowd pleaser. But will the Democrats actually make the decision to begin impeachment proceedings? I think it'll be a political decision. And I think that it's very attractive to certain forces. And I think if you're running for president, it's something you'd like to say if you want the Democratic Party to get behind you. But at the end of the day, would they really be able to win over the American people to thinking that Trump should be removed from office for what was in the Mueller report? That presents a question.
Caleb, to that point, and then let's move over to Planned Parenthood. I'm not certain that the Democrats could get a majority of the House to vote for impeachment.
I agree with you. I think that you're exactly right about that. And I think that not the whole Democratic Party is on board even, right? I'm not sure that this is really politically something that is realistic. But it's a crowd pleaser. And there's a lot of people who hate Trump, but let's remember that there is a big base of people who think Trump is the victim here and that this is political persecution and that Trump is just trying to, make America great again. And look, they're going after him. And in a way, impeachment could actually play into Trump's favor. The chances they could actually get the votes to remove him from office are not good. And he could then say, look, I'm being victimized. They've done a whole impeachment trial against me. That's how hard I'm fighting for you against the elites. An impeachment scenario may actually ultimately put Trump in a stronger position politically.
Jim Kavanaugh, you took us into this conversation, so I want to move on, starting with you. And I hope you guys got this because this just came out a little while ago. Judge rules in favor of Planned Parenthood. The license for Missouri's last abortion provider will not expire. According to court documents, Judge Michael Stetzler has ruled that the temporary restraining order is granted and petitioner's license shall not expire and shall remain in effect. The matter will be heard in court again on June 4th. The clinic's license to perform abortions was scheduled to expire at the end of today. Jim, your thoughts on this flood of cases at the state level, now moving into the federal district level, this move on Roe v. Wade?
Yeah, it's an all-fronts war. And, first of all, I'm very glad that the judge made that decision. I support abortion rights. And a horrible thing that they have already succeeded in reducing the availability of abortions for people around the country. And there's one
remaining clinic in Missouri. And, you know, that's terrible. And this, we should be in the streets about this. And there's an all-fronts war, legal lawfare by the anti-abortion rights movement to create, you know, they don't really think these laws are going to go into practice now. They're going to get injunctions against them probably most of the places. But they want to get something, a number of things up to the Supreme Court. It was interesting that in the there was a case that was decided where the Supreme Court a few days ago said, well, we won't decide part of this case because we only have one court coming to us, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They don't like to decide cases unless there's a disagreement between lower federal courts, and that's what the anti-abortion rights movement wants. They want to get a case that is directly challenging Roe v. Wade into the Supreme Court. That's not going to happen until a number of these cases go up the ladder of the courts, but eventually it will probably happen. And the main problem here for me is that, you know, the abortion rights movement has depended on the courts, and it's depended on Democratic Party leadership, and it depended on, you know, elite institutions, and they've lost a lot of the political war on the ground, which was why abortion rights were won to begin with, because that political war was fought and won on the ground. And they have to go back and do that. You know, they've lost all these state legislatures because they've allowed the gerrymandering and because they've allowed a whole set of ideological things out in the universe that go unchallenged on the ground.
Dr. Jack Rasmus, the religious right has been at this game since the early 70s. In fact, many would say that it's Roe v. Wade that energized, created the Christian right, moved them out of the pews and out of the pulpit into the politics.
Well, first of all, I wouldn't make too much of a TRO. You know, it's very easy to get a temporary restraining order in the court. It's far more difficult to get a permanent restraining order. So we'll see where that comes down in a couple months from now.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find very interesting about this all, and don't have any answer myself, is how did this thing get coordinated across all these states all at once, pretty much coming out with, you know, similar restriction of abortion rights? So who's behind that? Who had the plan to coordinate this? Was it simply, speakers of the legislatures who called each other up, or, what's behind it? Well, certainly the religious right is behind it, but somebody's really organizing this, and it would be interesting to know who it is.
That's a great question. I'm gonna dig into that and see if I can get an answer. Caleb, your thoughts?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and this might be a roundabout way of saying it, but, you know, Dr. Leon, both you and I have been to the Islamic Republic of Iran. And when I was in Iran, I remember I was talking to my guides, and I asked them, I said, what is the status of abortion in Iran? Is abortion legal in Iran? Is it illegal? And they said to me, in Iran, abortion is absolutely illegal unless the doctor says it's necessary. And I said, whoa, wait, what was that? And they said, yeah, well, you know, if a doctor thinks it's necessary for any reason, abortion is allowed. But other than that, it's illegal. And I said, wait a second. You're telling me, so in Iran, any doctor can perform an abortion as long as he says it's necessary for the woman's health or for any reason for the woman. And they said, yeah, but, you know, it's religiously frowned upon. It's something that goes against our religious beliefs as Muslims and all that. But yes, if a doctor says it's necessary, and if you look into it, it's actually easier to get an abortion in Iran than in the United States. If you look at the way abortion has been set up in the United States, right, it's not any doctor can do it, right? The doctor must get an abortion license, and he must do it at an abortion clinic. And these abortion clinics, like there's one in the state of Missouri. And if you look at the entire way abortion is legal in the United States versus the way it's illegal in countries like Iran, the whole thing is set up so that there's a culture war around it, right? I mean, it's legal, but it's done in a very, very, very stigmatized way. The whole thing is almost, you could say, a setup, right? You know, back in pre-World War I Germany, you had the Kaiser, and he used to stage Kulturkampfs or culture wars between the Catholic Germans and the Protestant Germans and the secular Germans. And these culture wars, often related to issues about things in the educational system or matters related to the state and outrated related to religion, they drew a dividing line down German society. And it was an effective way of weakening the rising trade union movement and social democracy. And I think that the abortion issue in the United States is a culture war, right? It is a divide among Americans that is not intended to be resolved. It's a way to get Americans who have their religious belief says that this is a human life that absolutely must be protected. Americans who say, well, actually, that's ambiguous, and so we should leave the choice up to the woman. You know, they're never going to see eye to eye on this. But if you can keep Americans at each other's throats over this, you can keep us divided, red states, blue states, you know, some religious beliefs versus some other religious beliefs. It's an effective way of keeping the country divided politically and preventing, you know, real issues that are, you know, issues where there could be more solidarity and more understanding, keeping those issues from coming to the front. It's a culture war that has been very effectively set up in the United States.
Great analysis, gentlemen. Thank you. It's Friday, so that means it's panel time, and you just heard Caleb Maupin. We're joined by Dr. Jack Rasmus, as well as Jim Kavanaugh. And folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and it's Friday, so that means it's panel time, and we are joined by Caleb Maupin. We are joined by Jim Kavanaugh, as well as Dr. Jack Rasmus. Gentlemen, thank you so much for staying with me. This just reported today, Julian Assange is suffering psychological torture, UN expert says. A United Nations expert on torture, Niles Melzer, said today that an examination of the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange in Britain's Belmarsh prison showed an alarming deterioration in his mental and physical state, and he sharply rebuked Britain, Sweden, and the United States for ganging up on Assange. The United Nations Special Rapporteur said the examination in early May revealed that Assange's capacity to focus and coordinate have been clearly affected by his imprisonment. And I know that, Jim, your latest op-ed is entitled Swedish Sex Pistol Aimed at Assange. Jim Kavanaugh, your thoughts, sir?
Well, this is very ominous news these last couple of days about Assange's health. This guy, Niels Melzer, is a real hero. This has been very good. It's a report that has been the demands and has gotten coverage in the mainstream media. He's been extremely strong in it. He himself, what's also interesting is that he himself says that, you know, he came to this with the same prejudices about Assange from the media that everybody else had, and only by doing the research and looking into the case in detail did he come to realize what was going on. So everybody who's made assumptions about Assange based on the mainstream narrative should take that to heart. His report is just devastating, and everybody should read it. In 20 years of work with victims of war, violence, and political persecution, never have I seen a group of democratic states ganging up to deliberately isolate, demonize, and abuse a single individual for such a long time, and with so little regard for the human dignity and the rule of law. The collective persecution of Julian Assange must end here and now. And, you know, the British have tried to respond to this quickly, not very cogently, and this is, you know, we really have to understand. My article was about the excuse of getting into Sweden, which they're going to try and use as a diversion. But I think at this point we have to think about the fact that it may be the case that they don't want Assange going to trial. And, you know, Karen Kwiatkowski has an article and was on Loud and Clear talking about this, that, and she and John Kiriakou said the CIA and the FBI have been interrogating them. And she says, you know, that her sources say they've been using hallucinogenic and psychotropic autogenic drugs, BZ, et cetera, and they might have had an effect on him, and they might be really damaging him. And he's had a severe, you know, he was in bad shape to begin with, and he's had a severe crash of his health since he's gone into the prison in Britain. So we have to be very on our toes here that they might just want to, it'd be all convenient for everybody else if he just died before any extradition had to be decided upon.
Caleb Maupin, Melzer also said in his statement that Assange should not be extradited to the United States, where he faces charges of conspiracy to hack into a Pentagon computer. He said that the cumulative effects of Assange's punishment can only be described as psychological torture.
The divide between Europe, Western Europe, the NATO countries in particular, and the United States has greatly expanded under the Trump administration, right? Trump's demanding those NATO countries pay money. He's demanding that Germany, not have this Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline. And you have to wonder, at this point, Julian Assange is not in the embassy anymore. He's in Britain. He's in jail in Britain, and he's being treated very badly. But he's not been handed over to U.S. officials yet. And, you have to wonder, is this divide between the United States and Europe, and now there's talk of sending him to Sweden, and is the U.S. government going to get its hands on Julian Assange? That remains an open question. I mean, I thought it was only a matter of time. I figured he would be already in the hands of U.S. officials by this time. I mean, the second that he was out of the embassy, I thought he would be in the USA the next day. But that's not the case. And there are clear divisions. Now, Assange, in addition to releasing everything that he released, he obviously made a lot of people angry, but it wasn't just U.S. officials who got angry about what Julian Assange released. There were many leaders, many figures around the world who were not happy with documents that were released. And this assumption that now that Assange is in the custody of British authorities, he'll immediately be handed over to to U.S. leaders, I don't think that's guaranteed, and I'm kind of surprised at how this is playing out. And I'm also, hearing this statement from the UN about, the fact that the man seems to be being tortured. Again, nothing about this case is as clear-cut as some people would assume it's going to be. Seeing this report come out, the fact that it is now public that he is being tortured, the fact that there's outrage about his treatment, the fact that he's not already been handed over to the United States, leads me to believe that things are not as hopeless for Assange as they could be.
Jack Rasmus, yesterday Assange was supposed to appear by video link from Belmarsh Prison in East London at a court hearing on the United States application for his extradition, but his British lawyer, Gareth Pearce, said her client was not well enough to participate. The presiding magistrate set June 12th for the next hearing and suggested it could be held in Belmarsh.
Well, I think, what the previous participant here mentioned, the fact that he's wasn't immediately extradited, so something's going on. Are the Brits holding him for something else in return? Who knows? But the longer it takes, the more likely that it's going to be a long time before they actually extradite him. And it may be that even on the U.S. side, there's not total agreement that they want to extradite him immediately. I don't know. I'm not into that that subject matter as much as the other speakers, but I do agree that the fact he wasn't immediately extradited means that there's a lot of politics going on.
There's an awful lot of politics going on, and not only in terms of, as Caleb mentioned, Western Europe and whatnot, but even within Britain itself. This is a very, very, very volatile case, but it's not going to be resolved anytime soon. The next issue, China puts U.S. soy buying on hold as tariff war escalates. According to Bloomberg, China, the world's largest soybean buyer, has put purchases of American supplies on hold as a trade war between Washington and Beijing escalates. State grain buyers haven't received any further orders to continue with the so-called goodwill buying and don't expect that to happen given the lack of agreement in trade negotiations. But China still currently has no plans to cancel previous purchases of soybeans. Dr. Jack Rasmus, your thoughts?
Well, I think we're going to see within the next few days a move by the Chinese that will be a ratcheting up of the trade war here. What form it takes is going to be interesting. I think this leaking of this soybean directive is just sort of a signal. We've seen signals about the rare earths might be restricted exporting a rare earth by China that, that produces most of them. There may be a move on the devaluation to the yuan. You know, what you got now is the dollar is rising everywhere because of the slowing global economy and the trade war, and money is flowing in to the U.S. into treasuries from everywhere, pretty much, you know, Europe, Latin America, Asia, as a haven. And that's driving the dollar up, and that's going to have to drive the yuan down. And it's already at its threshold of 6.9 to the dollar. So, you know, that could be another move. They can just allow the yuan to devaluate further, offsetting U.S. tariffs, of course, and say, well, the U.S. is doing it, not us. And, you know, President Xi gave this important statement about the economic long march very publicly, which is kind of like preparing the Chinese people for a protracted trade war, certainly until after the 2020 election here. That could be combined with a buy China, boycott America in China. I think we will see China picking out an American company or two in China and doing a tit-for-tat for the Huawei situation and sanctions here in the U.S. Could even be Apple. Remember, Huawei is the second largest distributor of smartphones in China. So if the U.S., I mean, if China really wants to do a tit-for-tat, it could just say, okay, Apple, we are going to make it more difficult for you to sell your smartphones in China. In general, what we're going to see is a ratcheting up, I think. How far they go next week is you know, going to be interesting to see, but we're on the verge. And already the markets around the world are getting very skittish. We've got a bond bust going on. Rates are falling and bond prices are rising everywhere. The most important event of this past week, and of course, the stock market goes down as the money flows out of stock market into bond markets. So this thing could really, you know, increase to a higher level of conflict between the two trade companies. And then, of course, we have Trump throwing oil on the fire here by declaring, even though he has an agreement with Mexico, he's going to slap 25% tariffs on Mexican cards.
We're going to get to that in just a minute. What company is the second largest seller of cell phones in China?
Huawei.
Okay. I wanted to be clear on that. Caleb, to Jack's point about the political strategic nature of this, China's clamping down on soybean purchases is, many believe, a direct strike at Trump's political base. In the 2016 election, he carried 8 of the 10 states with the largest soybean production, all of them in the Midwest. Iowa, the country's second largest soybean producer after Illinois, swung from Democrat to Republican in 2016, and this could have a backlash or backswing in 2020. Caleb, your thoughts?
It's certainly possible. I wouldn't be so sure that those states are going to flip blue over this issue, right? I mean, Iowa, Nebraska, places like that are, you know, those are red states.
Mm-hmm.
And while they might not agree with Trump on the trade tariffs, the idea that they're all just going to vote for Democrats culturally and all of that, that may not make perfect sense. You know, but then again, I mean, you know, things are very strange. We're in new political territory in the United States. And you know, on some level, Trump having a fight with China is good PR. He's able to present himself. And the latest tariffs against Mexico now, you know, he's slapping a tariff on them unless they get control of their issue with people illegally crossing into the United States. You know, I mean, this is theatrics, and this is something that Trump is trying to work his image as the guy who's fighting for the average American and making America great again. I mean, this is part of his image. This is part of what he does. And it may be that this trade war continues indefinitely, and it may be that it expands beyond Mexico even to other countries. I mean, this is, you know, this tariff stuff is something that Trump has figured out is a good crowd pleaser, as they say. So we shall have to see what happens next. But I can guarantee you, you know, China has very, very long-term thinking. President Xi Jinping is quite popular. And, you know, when he talks about a long march, I think that, the Chinese society is ready for that. They're going to stand behind President Xi, and they're ready. They're in for the long haul, as they say. We have very short attention spans in the United States. But, you know, there are documents from the Chinese Communist Party that talk about a 200-year plan, a 200-year vision for the country. I mean, I mean, this is a country that is very, very long-term thinking, so we should keep that in mind.
Jim Kavanaugh, the president moved to shore up support in rural America immediately as he escalated the trade dispute. He's got the Department of Agriculture with a $16 billion aid package to farmers, but farmers are saying, we don't want aid, we want trade. So your thoughts?
Yeah, that directly counteracts the whole ideology of the independent farmer, and we're not, you know, the whole ideology of the Republican Party and libertarianism, and don't depend on the state. Of course, the state steps in when it can to subsidize the constituencies it wants to subsidize, and this is a perfect example of that. And because it would be threatening to, farmers in the Midwest. I mean, this is soybeans is a huge crop. And if they start feeling, and they will very quickly start feeling the effects of this, it's going to hurt Trump politically. They might not vote for the Democrats, but they might just stay home, you know? So it's a very, you know, again, Trump doesn't know what he's doing with this. And he's going to end up hurting American workers and farmers more than hurting China. China has strength. China has dollar reserves. They have centralized management. They're not going to allow the kind of social damage to their economy and to their people that the U.S. couldn't prevent from happening, and that the U.S. would like to see occur in China and doesn't prevent from happening here. So, and China's built positive relationships, building things around the world. You know, as Gerald Horn says, China's in the passing lane. And this is from the Trump administration trying to throw down some spike strips. But China's going to find a way to drive right past them. And, you know, it's going to accelerate the ways in which China becomes more independent of the United States and the dollar. And it's going to be able, it becomes more able to shrug off these kinds of things. The Americans are defining themselves in the world as the country that makes military threats and economic threats and sanctions. It's not building anything. It's not offering a positive alternative. And that's going to hurt it, not in the long run, but in the medium run. You know, it's going to make everybody, the Germans and everybody else, say we need to find a way of distancing ourselves and being able to act independently, politically and economically, of the United States.
Jack Rasmus, final point to you. Bloomberg is writing that it's increasingly unlikely that American farmers will fully regain their share of the lucrative Chinese soybean market. Quote, the longer we are out of the China market, the likelihood is that we will not regain all of the share or all of the volume, according to Paul Burke, a senior director at the U.S. Soybean Export Council. He said this today. Do you see a long-term impact of losing market share the longer that Trump tries to play this hand?
Yes, I do, because China consumes an awful lot of soybeans, and they do it long-term contracts. These contracts are not harvest to harvest, and, you know, they're going to, as long as it appears that Trump and the U.S. Wing of the elite here is anti-China, and this is what this is all about, stop Chinese technology. They're going to ink longer-term contracts with others elsewhere, particularly Brazil and some other grain producers, and that will cause a loss of market share. Now, that raises the question, how long are you going to keep subsidizing U.S. farmers? $12 billion last year, $16 billion this year. This thing is certainly going to go into the election year. Another $20 billion, that's $50 billion. Where are you going to get the money for that? Well, Trump is probably going to call a national emergency, one of his national emergencies here, to save the farmers and probably divert money from, food stamps or Section 8 housing or something. If this goes on into next year, that's what you're going to see.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is Friday. That means it's panel time. You just heard Dr. Jack Rasmus. We're joined by Caleb Maupin and Jim Kavanaugh as well. You're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We're back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and it's Friday, so that means it's panel time. We've got Caleb Maupin, Dr. Jack Rasmus, as well as Jim Kavanaugh. Gentlemen, thank you so much for staying with me. And interesting result in Israel. They're now in what many are saying is uncharted territory, as Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu, failed to form a coalition. There was, you know, we talked about the possibility, I talked about it with a few folks on this show early in the week, about the possibility of this happening. But the prevailing sentiment or wisdom or thought was that Netanyahu would pull this out at the 11th hour. Well, a politically fatigued Israel has cranked back into election mode barely 50 days after its last national ballot and after the staggering failure of Netanyahu to form a government. So the next vote is set for September 17th. Caleb Maupin, does this signal anything to you about a possible beginning of an inkling of a shift in Israeli politics?
I think it does. And I think that, you know, that there has been a kind of a gap between Netanyahu's base and, you know, wider Israeli society. And that, you know, Netanyahu, you know, he depends on the votes of a lot of folks who immigrated to Israel from Eastern Europe in the 1990s, the folks building settlements, et cetera. And that there are a lot of Israelis that don't share his view. And when Netanyahu, let's never forget that when he went and spoke to the U.S. Congress to denounce President Obama and the Iran deal, that top Israeli generals and Israeli military leaders urged him not to do it. And that there's a lot of Israeli society that identifies with Europe, that identifies with France and Britain and Germany and other countries in Europe, has more of a European background, has been in Israel longer than just since the 1990s. And that has more of a view that finds Donald Trump to be rather repugnant and is not, you know, thrilled about the idea of an escalation with Iran. Let's not forget that when Trump spoke to the American Israeli Political Action Committee, you know, he was applauded, certainly, but there were a lot of people who walked out in protest of Trump being there. And, you know, while Hillary Clinton was certainly loved by the audience, there were a lot of Israeli supporters in the United States, even, who walked out when Trump addressed that during the election, when he addressed AIPAC. So that, you know, Israeli society is not completely unified, and that there are big differences, and that Netanyahu's base and Netanyahu's message, he may have, you know, a solid base of support, and there are people that absolutely support him, no question about it, but Israeli society is very different, and that there are different views and different forces there. And that, you know, that his alliance with Donald Trump is not something that every Israeli is going to support. I mean, globally, among people who identify as Jews, and even in the United States, among Jewish Americans, you know, Donald Trump is not loved. I mean, and Netanyahu's, you know, alliance with him, that is not something that is going to win him the popularity of Jewish people throughout the world. So I think that the situation there is starting to escalate, and that gap that has been developing in Israeli society for a long time is getting bigger, and that this failure to form a government, heading back to the polls soon, that's kind of a symptom of a growing gap between old Israel and new Israel, you could call it.
Jim Kavanaugh.
Well, I got to say, I think this is, you know, I saw it, Hanan Ashrawi yesterday, and I agree with her. This is, there's nothing in this that's of interest to progressives around the world. This was a fight between Trump, between Netanyahu and Avigdor Lieberman, between Netanyahu posing as, this is secular fascism versus religious fascism. It's like Trump versus Pence.
This is the right versus the ultra right.
Yeah, and it's the secular right versus the religious right.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't form a government with Trump
what's the difference?
Yeah, exactly, because Netanyahu wouldn't give the concessions to religious exemptions from the military that the Orthodox community wanted. So, you know, this is a family feud among fascists or apartheid colonialists, okay? And there's nothing in it for the Palestinians. There's nothing in it for anyone interested in peace and justice. Either one of these people, you know, and Netanyahu, the Trump will support Netanyahu. They've got family ties with Netanyahu. The Kushners, you know, are
literally family ties with him. Netanyahu used to sleep in Kushner's bed. So either of these, whoever wins this election, and in fact, Netanyahu attacked Lieberman as being of the left. So the political community and the political constituency in Israel is all to the right now. To be a leftist is to be denigrated and shamed. So whoever wins this election is going to continue the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, going to continue the push for war with Iran and Syria, and we'll get the backing of the U.S. to do that. Nothing good is going to come of this little family feud for the progressive forces in the world.
Jack Rasmus, following up on Kavanaugh's point, but a divided house can't stand. So, and that's why in my positioning the question to Caleb, Jim, I'm not saying that it's over in Israel for Netanyahu, but could we very well be seeing the beginning of a much larger problem? Jack Rasmus.
No, I don't think so. I agree. This is an in-house dispute, family dispute on the right and the far right here, with overtones of opportunism on the part of Lieberman. You know, Netanyahu's gotten some poor press. He's on the indictment and so forth. And I think this is an attempt by Lieberman to sort of take the crown of the right here and put it on his own head. And certainly if they have another election, that might be the first step in doing so. But, this changes nothing. And this is just, the right having an internal dispute among itself. And as was said, there is no social democracy to speak of anymore in Israel. Labor Party, I think, won only six seats or something. They're just about dead as they are dying everywhere else. So a house divided, it'll be a short-term division.
Yeah, but if Netanyahu is not prime minister, the right in Israel loses a very, very valuable marketer. The relationships that Netanyahu has formed, his command of English, he speaks better English than Lieberman does. There are a number of things that Netanyahu brings to the table in terms of the right and the interests of the right that Lieberman will have a real, or whoever the prime minister is, would have a difficult time filling. So, and again, I'm not saying it's over. I'm just saying this weakness to me is not good. And we'll just have to see going forward how this whole thing plays out. Real quick, gentlemen, as we wrap this up, Caleb, what are you looking at in the week to come?
Well, I've got my eyes on whatever is coming next. Now that the Bob Mueller report is over, what is going to do? What's going to happen in Congress? And I'm also watching this Democratic lead up to the Democratic primary elections. We've got so many different candidates at this point. This might be quite an exciting presidential primary.
Jim Kavanaugh, what are you looking at in this coming week?
I think the most urgent thing is the state of health of Julian Assange and whether he is going to be essentially paralyzed in his own defense and what's going to happen to him. I think this is an urgent thing and we should pay attention to it. And I'm very upset and feeling very ominous about what's going to happen.
Dr. Jack Rasmus, what's on Jack Rasmus's radar?
Whether the bond markets are going to continue to accelerate their decline when China comes out with its responses to new measures next week, I think that's very clear because that may precipitate a more major correction in the stock markets. And then also what Lopez Obrador is going to do or say in response to Trump.
Well, folks, let me tell you that Jack Rasmus has his op-ed, Mueller Talks and the Tyrant Walks. Jim Kavanaugh has Swedish sex pistol aimed at Assange, and you can go to CalebMaupin.com. Go to CalebMaupin.com and check out his work as well, folks. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here next week on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.